Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. Historian and mystery writer Jason Goodwin won a huge international following when he invented Investigator Yashin, the eunuch private eye to the Ottoman Sultan. Goodwin's hero strides through the bustling streets of 1830s Istanbul, solving murders woven into the great historical events of the age. Author and hero are back and in top form in Goodwin's latest novel. This hour, On Point, The Last Days of the Ottoman Empire, with historian novelist Jason Goodwin and investigator Yashin. Joining me now from Exeter in England is Jason Goodwin. He is the author of a history of the Ottoman Empire called Lords of the Horizons. His first Investigator Yashin novel was called The Janissary Tree. And the second book in the series is just out. It's called The Snake Stone. And it is a great read. Jason Goodwin, welcome.
Oh, hello, Jane. Many thanks.
So when your first novel is an international bestseller, do you get at least a little nervous with the writing and the release of the second book?
The second album syndrome.
Yes.
Yeah. It's just you get your head down and get on with it. It was good. I mean, it's been great.
So the book is set in 19th century Istanbul, as I said, during the reign of the Sultan Mahmud II, right?
Yeah.
Why did you choose Istanbul in the 1830s?
Oh, wow. I mean, that's... Jane, 17 years ago, when the Berlin Wall came down, 1990... I sort of fulfilled this lifetime dream of going to visit Istanbul. It was a place I'd always sort of thought about. It kind of lived in my head like a sort of dream. You know, this place where East meets West, this place that stands on the Bosphorus, and you can stand on the Asian side and look across into Europe. And I wanted to go there, and I decided to walk there. I live in England, so I couldn't walk straight out from England. But we walked down from Poland down to Istanbul.
You walked.
Yeah.
How long did it take you?
6 month journey. It was about 2,000 miles. We just knocked on doors when evening fell. We would kind of arrive in some village and knock on a door and say, "Could we sleep in your barn?" And they would say yes.
Fabulous.
They did every
how
time.
How was it? What was that experience like?
Well, you know, I went with two friends, one of whom I'm afraid I've never seen since, and the other one I'm married to. So it was a courtship of sorts.
I see. That's quite a courtship.
And what happened, Jane, really what happened on that trip was that you sort of move back into a different rhythm. Walking takes you into a different kind of world. And we moved into, I think, a sort of more medieval kind of mindset. And one was very aware, as in the northern parts of Europe, in Poland, Slovakia, and so on, of this backwash of empires. You know, the Russians were leaving, as it were. They were moving out of that part of Eastern Europe. There were also echoes of the German influence in that part of the world, too. Mm. And those two empires seemed to be, you know, we felt we were walking through lands that had always been kind of crushed between these two other powers, until there was a point where we hit another line, some sort of invisible boundary, entering Romania, I guess, and there, suddenly things changed. You know, the coffee became really good. Gypsies wearing fantastically colourful costume, great printed cottons, the sight of a minaret, different sorts of music. And in my 26-year-old ignorance, I realised that we'd come into the area which Istanbul sort of, you know, the pulse from Istanbul was coming from. That's where these beautiful cottons were coming from. That's where the coffee was coming out of. There was some culture which was based in Istanbul, the place we were going to, our sort of our holy grail, if you like. Mm. And we were now there in it. And that was fascinating to see that change. And that really, you know, changed the direction of my life.
Well, walk us into the streets of 1830s Istanbul. You gave us just a taste. Before you do, though, let me read this review from the New York Times of your book. Yashin, the main character, glides easily and unthreateningly through the strata of Istanbul's highly nuanced culture, to the point where that culture is one of Mr. Goodman's most evocative ingredients. So tell us more about the culture of the time. What was it like during the Ottoman Empire? Walk us into those streets of 1830s Istanbul.
Well, I mean, when would you start to walk? You know, you're walking into a place which has been a capital and a great world capital since the fourth century. This is a city which is also known as Constantinople, founded by the Emperor Constantine as the new Rome. Back in the 4th century, he needed to, Rome was collapsing itself. So the whole shift and focus of the Roman Empire was moving to the east, and he dedicated this place. He discovered this wonderful site and started to build the city. So you have to imagine that in the 1830s, we're not looking not only at an empire, an Ottoman Empire that's been entrenched in that very city since 1453, when the Turks took it from the Greeks, but also the time before that, you know, 1,000 years and more going on behind that, when... So it's a city of incredible monuments. I mean, obviously the greatest, perhaps, I would say one of the great wonder of the world really is Hagia Sophia, the great church, the Church of the Holy Wisdom, which stands there. Yes. And was built in the 6th century by the Emperor Justinian. Obviously not actually by the Emperor Justinian, for the Emperor Justinian, by Armenian architects. And
so it's really a melting pot of ethnic factions and so many other things. A continental crossroads, if you will, is how you're
absolutely
describing it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I often say, you know, it's like a turnstile. It's not just between that part of sort of Balkan Europe and Anatolia and the Middle East. It's also because of the Bosphorus. You know, you're getting huge influences coming down from the Black Sea, which is at one end of the Bosphorus, and at the other end you've got the Mediterranean. So this is a city that's linked to so many different major kind of cockpits of history, major... religious currents, racial currents, and so on. So Istanbul, you know, people would go there and they would say, this city is destined to be the capital of the world. And that was certainly how the Ottomans viewed it. But I mean, foreigners coming there too would say they'd just never seen anything quite like it.
So would you describe this book as much of a history lesson in the richness of the culture that you describe and the time and the period in history as much as it is a tale of intrigue, a mystery?
Well, I wrote a history book, as you mentioned in the intro, you know, Lords of the Horizons, which was my response to The Walk, in a way, and it was my effort to kind of discover who these Ottomans were. I would say that, yes, what I hope people will get from the Snake Stone and the Janissary Tree and the Yashim Adventures is a strong sense of the atmosphere of that period. I wouldn't say it's a history lesson, because when I sat down to write them as thrillers, you know, I always said to myself, it's the story comes first, the story comes out of character. And to be honest with you, you know, if the story and history collide, then history has to step back. Because otherwise you're not creating, you know, really what you've got to do is you've got to create something that people really want to read and they want to turn the page. And then you can slip in the information.
Well, let us read a bit. I want you to read a book, a bit, actually, from your book. This is a description of the decline of the Ottomans during their empirical rule.
Well, it's early on in the Snake Stone, and here it is. The Sultan lay back on the pillows of an enormous tester bed hung with tasseled curtains and gazed through red-rimmed eyes at the Bosphorus below his window and the hills of Asia across the straits. He had, he dimly knew, a world at his command. The fleets of the Ottoman Sultan cruised in the Mediterranean and the Black Sea. The prayers were read in his name at the mosque in Jerusalem, in Mecca and Medina. His soldiers stood watch on the Danube by the iron gates and in the mountains of Lebanon. He was Lord of Egypt. He had wives. He had concubines. He had slaves at his beck and call, not to mention the pashas, the admirals, the seraskiers, voivodes, and hospodars, who governed his far-flung empire in trembling, or at least respectful, obedience to his will. And what we're doing there, I mean, there is really a set up, this is the Sultan dying. He has this power that I'm describing there, and yet, of course, already by the, this is 1838, 1839, already it's a sort of, it's very much a nominal power. It's true, you know, the fleets are there, the concubines are there, but the Ottomans are losing their grip on that world. And
well, remind us at their height, remind us how extensive it was, the Ottoman Empire.
Yeah, I mean, okay, Suleiman the Magnificent, 16th century, 1520s to the 1560s. Suleiman not only inherits his father's, his father kind of pushed the borders of the empire out east, right the way into Iran. He went down into Arabia. He took Mecca and Medina and Jerusalem and so on. He pushed them very far to the east. Suleiman, who inherited that side of this great eastern expansion of the empire, he then took it right the way down into Europe, across the Mediterranean. You know, he had fleets attacking the Spaniards in Spain. He even had his fleet at one point was put up by the French for a year because they were allies. I mean, believe it or not, Suleiman also led armies twice all the way to Vienna. I mean, that's right the way across the Balkans, right the way into Central Europe. And he besieged Vienna twice. He could never quite crack Vienna because it was just that little bit too far. You know, you can't, in those days, I mean, you could only campaign, there was a campaign season. And after the season was over, you had to start to get home and the men had to go back and start doing work in the field. So he could never quite go further than that. But imagine, and they went all, they controlled the Black Sea. There was an effort shortly after Suleiman's death to build to dig a canal between the Volga and the Don in the steppe. I mean, these people controlled Egypt all the way down to North Africa. So basically the whole Mediterranean world, the whole of the Black Sea, all the Balkans, right the way into Central Europe, and a great swathe of the Middle East as well, was under their control.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the real Istanbul of the 1830s as the Sultan and his once great Ottoman Empire both lay dying, and the fictional character Investigator Yashim, who strides through those streets solving mysteries that are intricately woven into the society and the politics of the times. My guest is Jason Goodwin, historian and mystery novelist, author of the international bestseller The Janissary Tree and now The Snake Stone. I want to start off the segment with a caller from Harvard, Massachusetts. Amy is on the line. Hi, Amy. Welcome.
Hi. It's so great to talk to you both. I am such a huge fan, and I was just so pleased that you won the Edgar for the Janissary Tree.
Well, thanks, Amy. Yeah, that was a shock and a delight too. It's a prize. It's a mystery book prize, isn't it? It's the Mystery Writers of America give you know these prizes every year, and Janissary Tree won it. So,
do you have a question, Amy, for Jason?
It's so evocative. It is unbelievable. I'm actually grateful that I can't smell it because you bring everything so to life, and some of the smells are a little bit frightening that you describe, and I'm so looking forward to more of them. I am curious, some of my favorite characters, your minor characters, the Polish ambassador and the Walid, and I'm curious if they are entirely fiction, or if indeed Istanbul was one of the few places that did continue having a Polish ambassador without a Poland, and was it often that concubines would be European and could rise to the place of the Walid?
Good question, Amy. Thank you. Jason?
Yeah, well, the Polish, you're absolutely right. You see, the Polish ambassador is a figure in my story, but it is true that by the beginning of the 19th century, Poland had been scrunched off the map. I mean, the Austrians, the Prussians and the Russians had basically invaded the place and divided it up. So it didn't exist. But the Ottomans had been great enemies of the Poles in their day of greatness. And they used to battle it out on the sort of frozen rivers of the steppe with one another. And when the Poles were finally kind of extinguished as a nation, the Ottomans refused to acquiesce in this. They simply didn't recognize the fact that Poland had disappeared. And it was a sort of, you know, among other things, it was a kind of grand gesture. And also they did it to irritate the Russians, clearly. But they would have, when they were through, if there was a big ball or a big, big number, and people would be, they'd announce at the door, the Russian ambassador, the ambassador from the Habsburgs. They would then announce the ambassador from Lechistan, which is the name they gave Poland. And of course, no one would ever come in. There was no ambassador from Lechistan. So all I had to really do was open that door and bring in Paliewski, who becomes my Polish ambassador. So in a sense, I hope it's true to the sort of atmosphere of it, if it's not literally true.
You mentioned some of the minor characters. Let's start, go back to the major character, Yashim, this investigator, the sleuth, Yashim Togalu. Is that how you say it? A eunuch with some admirable social skills. How would you describe him?
Yashim has, he's a, you know, he's a, he, he's a nice looking guy. He's sort of in his early 40s, late 30s, whatever. But he has this he has two qualities, I suppose. One is that he can make himself invisible. He can just be somebody that nobody really notices. And I think that comes out of the fact that he is a eunuch. And I am not, I'm not telling the whole eunuch story straight off. I'm going to let that one come out slowly in the books and the sort of the backstory of that. But
well, how did you come up with him though, in the first place? How did you come up with this character, Rashim?
Well, you know, when I was thinking of doing a sort of doing a detective story and it would be set in Istanbul, one of the things, I mean, there were eunuchs in Istanbul. That's a given. And in fact, there were eunuchs in empires stretching all the way back to the days of Darius, you know, the Persian Empire, Alexander the Great, in China, ancient China, right up to, in fact, one of the last Chinese eunuchs died only about 10 years ago, a palace eunuch. These were people who worked in imperial palaces all over the world, and yet they were unable they couldn't have children. They couldn't sort of, as it were, interfere with the ruler's family, interfere with his women. But they were, in that sense, they were the perfect servants. They couldn't found a new dynasty that would sort of threaten the ruler himself. So really their loyalty and their lives were devoted to the guy in authority. So they have a long history. So given that there are eunuchs in Istanbul, it seemed to me that, you know, when you think about it, I mean, even my favourite detectives, like, well, obviously Sherlock Holmes, Philip Marlowe, they're eunuchs. You know, when you kind of think it out, they don't, you know, Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie's detective, he's absolutely a eunuch. These are people who are living, they live in this, you know, they're members of the society that they're interested in, that they're patrolling, but they're not quite, they're not quite connected to it. They come at it at an angle because there's something, you know, they're lonely, really. I mean, I think that's certainly true of Holmes, certainly of Philip Marlowe. You know, they're loners. I mean, Chandler actually put it very well. He said, you know, he wanted a detective who could walk down mean streets but was not himself mean. And he said he would be a lonely man. And I think that in that sense, making Yashim a eunuch is just taking it one sort of, as it were, sort of formalizing that relationship.
So read a description of Yashim, would you, from the book?
I wonder if I have something here. This is where we're introducing him, and he's come in to take some coffee in his in the cafe he likes near his home. In a long cloak, somewhere between deep red and brown, and a saffron-coloured robe, Yashim might have been a ruck in the carpet. Only his turban was dazzlingly white. But Yashim's invisibility was also a quality in the man, if man was the proper word. There was a stillness about him, a steadiness in the gaze of his grey eyes, a soft fluidity to his movements, or an easiness of gesture that seemed to deflect attention rather than attract it. People saw him, but they did not quite notice him either, and it was this absence of hard edges, this peculiar withdrawal of challenge or threat, that comprised his essential talent and made him, even in 19th century Istanbul, unique. Yashim did not challenge the men who met him or the women. With his kind face, grey eyes, dark curls barely touched at 40 by the passage of the years, Yashim was a listener, a quiet questioner, and not entirely a man. Yashim was a eunuch. He took his coffee propped up on one elbow and etched the churek, brushing the crumbs from his moustache.
So how does his role then as a eunuch influence his character and then his skills, really, as a private investigator?
Well, you know, I think he's been to a very dark place. I mean, that's the basis of his character. He's been to this terrifying place, into this despair, which I explore a bit in the Snake Stone. And how do you come out of that? How do you actually come out of, you know, you've been castrated, that whole, your future has been kind of taken away, but obviously you have a future, you live, you carry on. What do you do? So Yashim, because he's a good man, I think he sees that the way he can go on is to try to help other people. He has this tangential view of the world he's in. He sees what, as it were, you know, the human comedy. He sees what fools people make of themselves in a way, but in an affectionate way. And he can see when they're about to step on a drawing pin or, you know, sit down without a chair behind them, as it were. So he wants to go forward and help. And I think it's by serving others that he finds his own kind of peace of mind.
Tell us about some of the other very vibrant characters in the book who, by turns, are hoodwinking one another all over the place. The French archaeologist who arrives in Istanbul.
Oh, he's fun, yeah.
Yeah.
The terrible Maximilien Lefebvre. He's very much of it that time. I mean, that's what, you know, we're talking about Istanbul as a melting pot. By the 1820s, 30s, you know, there were a lot more foreigners, Westerners coming to Istanbul than had before, and they were traveling in greater freedom. So Lefebvre is there. He's out. He's got something. He's on the make. He's looking for something. He's an archaeologist. We don't like the sound of him, I think, when he first appears. But Yashim finds himself becoming more involved than he either wished or expected very soon, when Lefebvre finds himself in big trouble. He was fun to create.
All your characters are so... well, they're just so beautifully described, I guess. The Lord Byron's doctor, the Sultan's West Indies-born mother. I love the widow who tends the chickens as a young woman, and now in her 70s, she still thinks about those 40 birds, right?
Yes, all those birds and her handsome husband who came galloping in and scattered them all to the roof of the coop. I can't really actually claim very much credit because these people just jump off the... out of the situation, you know. I mean, it is such a rich world that I'm, you know, lucky to be writing about. So there they are. I mean, what can I say? Quite often, I mean, when they do just literally walk off the page. So the Valide, the Sultan's mother, who is indeed French born, she came from Martinique. She was a Creole. She's there. She has to come in. Yeah. Palevsky, the ambassador. He came in partly because I suddenly realized as I was writing the first one that every detective needs to have a friend he can talk to. Otherwise, there's no way he can get, you know, can't say what's going on to the reader. But thank God he did, you know, and he was fun.
So tell us a little bit and read a little bit from the book some more about the harem, about being allowed into the harem
right.
in 1830s Istanbul.
Well, it's funny, isn't it? Everyone, you know, that's what everybody really wants to hear about, the harem. and they want to know about how if he's a eunuch, you know. But you're right. I mean, the harem, can I just set that scene a little?
Yes, please.
And the importance of the harem, wildly sort of exaggerated in Western imaginations, you know, the sort of Orientalist, exotic imagination. The harem is a place of kind of lascivious, kind of sort of sex frolics for all nonstop. So much not what it was. You know, the harem was much more like a combination between a sort of boarding school, sort of girls' boarding school, and a sort of bureaucracy. So it was, you know, obviously the purpose of it really was to provide the Sultan with access to women so that the heir to the throne, you know, they were guaranteed to get an heir to the throne. But apart from that, it was really quite a tightly controlled, you know, very bureaucratic. It was like a sort of busy office. But here is Yashim, nonetheless, it had its exotic side. So here's Yashim coming in to meet his friend, the Valide. The door closed behind him. He heard the slap, slap of slippers on the flags, and an old black man in a beautifully embroidered kaftan and a vast white turban came around a corner, fanning himself with a fan made of reeds. "Hello, Hyacinth."
"Oi, oi, Yashim, it's getting late."
"I'm sorry." Only 2 or 3 years earlier, this would have been the most important time in the life of the harem, the hour of gossip and intimacy over food, when thousands of succulent dishes would stream from the palace kitchens to the Sultan's apartments. The hour, above all, of the Ghuzdeh's final preparations, bedecking, perfuming, calming the nerves of the girl fortunate enough to have been selected to share the Sultan's bed that night. The whole harem would have fluttered and twittered like a forest of little birds. The stillness was audible now. "Ask the Valide, Hyacinth, if she will receive me." That's Yashim.
Yeah.
You know, he's moving there into... We're talking about this sort of period. There's a period of change, and the Sultan's moved out of the Topkapı Palace, which is the great palace built by the Ottoman Sultans, beginning with Mehmet the Conqueror, who took Istanbul back in the 15th century. And now, you know, we're in a sort of Top Kapi is more or less half abandoned. It's the sort of afterglow of its great days. But his friend, the Valide, who's an old woman, is still there. And she has a kind of skeleton staff, as it were, who attend to her. So there's a sort of wistfulness when he goes to visit her in this part of the, in this harem.
I want to take a turn here for a moment and end this segment with the story of sort of how you got the bug of murder mysteries and writing these mysteries. I was fascinated to hear of your childhood sitting with your father on the set of Murder on the Orient Express. Yeah. He was the producer of that, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was. It was a Sidney Lumet film. I mean, he went on, he made a number of Agatha Christie films. And Murder on the Orient Express. I mean, the Orient Express was the great train that ran from Paris to Istanbul. And in fact, in that movie, the great part of that film is at the very beginning with great music, rich Rodney Bennett music, and then the light of the train lights up at the front.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know.
So did that experience turn you on to murder mysteries?
I've always liked them. I mean, Agatha Christie actually isn't really my bag. Raymond Chandler's my hero. I mean, he's a sort of superhero because I think that what he's done with sort of 1920s, 30s LA is just extraordinary. I mean, without ever having, none of us have been to a 1930s LA, but that's what it is for me. I mean, it's always going to be like that. It's an incredible sort of tour de force. But yeah, I guess he did. I mean, I think one of the things was often when they did the scripts of these films, they discover that Agatha Christie's plot completely fell apart when they, when you try and break these things down and then reassemble them for a 2-hour movie, you think, she fudged that one.
Right.
But then again, Chandler wasn't too worried about plot. And when Howard Hawks rang him up and said, we've got the script, but who killed the fourth guy? And Chandler says, well, which fourth guy? that's fine by me. I think that's okay. I mean, I tried to keep these plots kind of tight enough. But
is your father still alive?
Yeah.
And what does he think of this turn that you've taken?
Oh, he's been great. I mean, I give him the manuscripts when I'm writing them, and he comes up with he can come up with some good things. You know, it's very good. Have a killer sort of some sort of technique. I thought, oh yeah, that is a good idea. But actually, funny enough, I suppose he's been a real sort of influence in that way. But what really kind of made me think, let's write a thriller, was the fact that my mum reads about 6 or 7 of them a week. And my sisters are really keen on them. And, Jane, to be frank, if you're writing books and you go to the bookstore and the books guy says, well, look, 70-80% of all books are bought by women.
That's right.
So it seems pretty futile to kind of run in the opposite direction. Let's write some detective stories.
Fabulous.
Derim neden yoksun gezdiğim bak.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, we're discussing the world of investigator Yashim, where intrigue and murder tug at the threads of history in 19th century politics. My guest is Jason Goodwin, author of Lords of the Horizons, an award-winning history of the Ottomans and of the internationally best-selling mystery, The Janissary Tree. His hero, investigator Yashim, returns in his just-published novel, The Snake Stone. Let's go to the phones now, first up out of the break, and get to Concord, Vermont, where David is calling. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Hello.
I enjoyed both of your books very much, Mr. Goodwin, both the mystery and the history, and I have actually two short questions related to each one. The first is serious, the second more interesting. The second question first. In the mystery story, Yashim, who's a eunuch, has a rather intimate experience with a stunning Russian princess. I didn't know that eunuchs were capable of that. First question. The second one is, in your history book, it seems that the Ottoman Empire survived and prospered as long as it was expanding and could suck wealth from the areas it had just taken, and then once it was stopped, it began to decay. Is that roughly correct in your mind?
David, thank you. Second question first, Jason.
I think that's. I mean, that really is. It's expand or die. And I think that was the case with a lot of empires. But certainly, the genius of the Ottomans was to. CEOs take note. I think this is what happens in large companies too. That they've got to find some way of sustaining the momentum of the original momentum of expansion, and that involves bringing in people from the periphery. You have to pick up the, you have to get the bright, sort of energetic, unorthodox thinking that happens on the frontier, the ever-expanding frontier, and bring it to the centre to kind of, and then send it out again. You've got to, do you know what I mean? You've got to keep sort of turning it over, and they were able to do that, I think, right up to, well, you know, set a date on it, you know, 1580, say. And then that whole thing began to atrophy. They could no longer get any further. They could, as I was saying earlier, you know, they physically couldn't really travel much further in, on campaign in a season. So they found a limit. They could no longer bring in new blood. They could no longer take on, as David says, wealth from the periphery. And so they began to, they ossified, you know, they became like drying clay. They began to crack. And I think that their response to that is absolutely fascinating, because, I mean, what's incredible about, again, about the Ottoman Empire is everyone says, oh, well, you know, it rose and then it declined. But the so-called decline lasted for 300 years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Ottomans were still going after the First World War. So it was, there was something there that was still incredibly strong, and some sort of structure there which was almost, you know, just lasted for such an incredibly long time, despite everything that was being thrown at it. But I think Dave's right. I think that that is my thesis, that ultimately it could no longer expand, therefore it began to shatter. Hmm. Yeah.
And then to David's first complicated and sensitive question.
Yeah, very nicely put.
Yes.
Funnily enough, actually, I was in Italy this weekend, and there I met a critic, and he said, well, there's one thing, you know, I was worried about. And he mentioned that very thing that David mentioned about the Night of Passion. And then he said, but I asked a doctor, a friend of mine, and the doctor said, yes, it's okay. So he was happy. So I'm happy too.
Well
I mean,
stated.
Seriously, there are degrees of unicry. I think that was that's how one might put it.
Okay. From Columbia, South Carolina, Eric is on the line. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Jane. How are you?
Good. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Thank you for Mr. Goodwin for being on the show. I greatly enjoyed your first work, Lords of the Horizon.
Well, thank you.
I read your mystery. Looking forward to those. My question relates to the role of political Islam shifting from the 19th century to contemporary Istanbul. Mm. I did something similar to you in 1998. Was my first trip. I walked and hitchhiked from Bosnia to Istanbul, I stayed in Istanbul in 2000, and then again in 2002 for several months.
Right.
And I'm noticing a change in the view of the general population from the traditional reverence for Kemal Atatürk to more political Istanbul. I'm wondering if what your views are on political Islam in Turkey at this time.
Good question, Eric. Thank you.
Yeah, I think that is a really interesting question. And I suppose what I would say is that I'm not at all fazed by the sort of gentle, as it were, sort of mild Islamification of Turkish political life, partly because I think what Atatürk did in the 1920s was both unbelievably bold and brave, and he's been rightly celebrated for, as it were, taking Turkey, this sort of kind of shattered and dismembered country, by the scruff of its neck and dragging it, kicking and screaming, into the 20th century, giving it alphabet and making it very Western, putting everybody into a Homburg hat and a raincoat. And that was fine, and I'm sure that was a very good response to what to various things that needed to happen. You know, Turkey needed to go through a secularization period, it needs to become aware of itself. But I think that a lot was also lost in that process. And I think one of the things that Turks lost, I mean, you know, I don't want to pontificate about what Turks think, because I'm not a Turk myself, and what right have I, but this is what I observe. And I think that for instance, I mean, reading Orhan Pamuk's book about Istanbul in the 50s and 60s, you know, the Nobel Prize winner, you know, the world that he's describing is one where the past has been, is, you know, it's a very odd thing, I think, for people to have their past cauterized, so that they are no longer able to relate to their origins in that sense. You know, their founding myth has been kind of erased, and that's in essence, it's sort of what Atatürk did. I mean, that was the effect of it. And I think that now what I notice, and I don't know whether Eric would agree from his time living there, but what I notice is that there's a much more relaxed attitude now emerging towards the relationship between Turkey, modern Turkey, and the Ottoman Empire, which I think is also, I think is healthy. And I think that certainly acknowledging a sort of, you know, the Islamic component in that is healthy and important, and will allow, you know, I think it'll allow a greater deal of freedom. So I'm very sort of hopeful about that that situation, actually.
Eric's question sparks a question actually in my mind about how Islam played during this period and the decadence and the cosmopolitanism of the period and how that worked into it.
I think that it was an Islamic empire. The ruler was a Muslim. Muslims had, as it were, they were the sort of first class citizens. Everybody else was a second class citizen. But at the same time, I think that there was a different worldview, and it was a different it was an ancien regime view of people, which I think I feel. I mean, this is again sense of atmosphere and so on, but I feel actually gave more respect to the individuals. People were acknowledged for what they were. They weren't sort of dragooned into you know, sort of bureaucratic regiments, as we all are nowadays. You know, there was a sort of fluidity and a give and take in the relationship between people. And you know, certainly you find that the sort of tolerance and coexistence was one of the great achievements of that empire. Certainly was a feature of what we might call Levantine life for centuries, and it doesn't seem to be any you know, it's not by chance that once that's destroyed, then we've unleashed in that particular area the most horrific sort of racial ethnic tensions, which which may have existed before, but they were certainly sort of it was a much smoother relationship that people have with one another. I think that's true.
That's interesting. Let's go to another call now in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. Tiano is on the line. Hi.
Yeah, hi.
Hi, go ahead. You're on the line.
Well, I want to tell you, I appreciate that you're talking about the most beautiful city in the world. I was born there. And it's a very pretty. It's the queen of the cities.
Ah, queen of the cities, yes.
Yes, ma'am, that's why. That's why when we call it the city, we call it, it's written with a capital C. It's the only, if you know city, usually you don't, but every time we write about the city, that means Constantinople or Istanbul.
Thank you. Thanks so much. I understand Tiano is Greek from Istanbul, so I appreciate that call. Thank you.
Wonderful.
Hey, Jason, read us another bit from the book, would you? I'm interested. I love your description of the people of Istanbul and the streets of Istanbul. Let's start with the people.
Some people. Here is Yashim sitting on the amazing street, which was called the Grande Rue de Pera, and was the great thoroughfare in the old European quarter of Istanbul. An elderly Greek, bent at the waist, hands clasped behind his back, was coming down the side of the road. He wore a red fez, a long jacket, and white pantaloons. Every so often he stopped to look in a shop window, or craned his neck to inspect some new building work. Once he turned around completely to follow the swaying hips of a pretty Armenian woman with a basket and her hair in a plait. His blue eyes sparkled under a pair of bushy white eyebrows. When he caught sight of Yashim, he stopped again, smiled and raised those eyebrows slightly as if they shared a joke together, or a regret, before resuming his stately progress down the Grande Rue de Pera. A group of Franks, led by a man with a huge belly who mopped his brow repeatedly with a handkerchief, sauntered along the road. The men wore black coats and striped waistcoats. The ladies wore bonnets and turned their heads about like blinkered horses. Yashim couldn't catch what they were saying, but guessed they were Italians, probably staying at one of the new lodging houses higher up the street. Their dragoman carried a fly whisk and wore a moustache. Yashim wondered if he was Greek, but thought not. More likely an Italian-speaking native of Pera, descended from the city's original Genoese inhabitants.
So who were the Franks?
The Franks are Westerners. Franks, it's like French. that was the sort of to be Frankish was to be Western European, essentially. Mm. And that's just this is just simply one little glimpse of what one might see in that particular part of Istanbul. I mean, other parts you would see, much more, perhaps more traditional people. Mm. So, but there was certainly a time of extraordinary change then. The 1830s is a time that's giving way to another era. Mm.
How do Turks today regard the final days of the Ottomans? Are they nostalgic? Do they see that era as somewhat decadent or backward in any way?
I think that's probably the worst time. I mean, this is my impression, is that it's probably the worst time. It was a time of, humiliation, and weakness, and the empire. I mean, you have to imagine this was a huge, as we've discussed before, great multi-ethnic empire stretching over great swathes of around that part of the world. I mean, thousands of miles. And by the 19th century was its sort of crisis point, and there were many, many questions were thrown up by its decline and by events in Europe, the Greek War of Independence, this idea of national self-determination. How could that fit with the idea of a sort of multi-ethnic empire? How would that work? The efforts, for instance, to incorporate. They tried very hard to make it so that, there was sort of equal law for everyone. But how was that going to work, given that Muslims were supposed to be the dominant party in this relationship? Then there was an extraordinary sort of outburst of, there was decadence. The sultans could spend far too much money. They got involved in extravagances. They also got involved in wars. By the end of the 19th century, in essence, they were being propped up by the foreign powers. And everyone says, Turkey was known as the sick man of Europe. That was the Russian phrase. And the Russians rather hoped to be the undertakers as well. And of course, inspired everybody else to kind of, the Russians wanted to go into Constantinople. They saw that as being perhaps the sort of culmination of their own sort of millennial dream, the sort of third Rome and so on. And so the other European powers were forced to, they had to be on the defensive. They had to prop up the Ottoman Empire. And so the empire itself really never really got a full chance to kind of work out its problems. And meanwhile, the weaker it became, the less attractive it became for the various peoples of the empire to remain in it. I mean, it became obvious for the Greeks they'd be much better if they could get independence.
I want to get another caller in here, Jason. Anne is on the line from Duxbury, Massachusetts. Hi, Anne.
Hello there, Jane. How are you?
Good.
And to your wonderful guest. I'm thoroughly enjoying this. I'm wrapping gifts this morning, so I'm treating myself to a good listening period. I just wanted to share with your guest that I grew up in Ireland and was blessed with a dad who read aloud to us. And my early memories sitting around the fire in the winter of listening to 1001 Arabian Nights and magical stories. And I've had the good fortune of having been to Turkey and visited Istanbul. What I also wanted to pick up on was a previous caller had mentioned about the powers of the eunuch. and I kept a clipping from about 10 years ago in the New York Times, the death of the last eunuch of the Chinese emperor. And, of course, the eunuch had a lot of interior power within the structure of that kind of empire, was very often given the task of holding secrets. And so I'm looking forward to your book and wondering how many more secrets will be revealed from the empire itself.
Anne, thank you. Good luck with those gifts. Jason.
Yeah. What's so wonderful about this is that and makes it such fun. These are incredibly good fun to write. I have to admit that. You can write histories and travel books and things, but they're quite hard work. And writing these mysteries is, it's hard work, but it's great fun. And I see that there are lots of secrets, and there are lots of ways of looking at that particular city. It's such an important, big, vibrant place. There's so many different ways you can cut that cake. So I can't see that there'll be any, there are endless alleyways where new secrets will be pouring out of harems and so on. So I think and it's fun.
Jason Goodwin is the author of two mysteries featuring investigator Yashim. This latest is The Snake Stone, which is just out in hard copy. Of course, the international bestseller was The Janissary Tree. So nice to have you. I have to tell you, Istanbul is one of my favorite cities. So it's a real treat to read your book and a treat to have you on as a guest. Oh, thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Thanks very much.
Listeners, you can continue our conversation and download the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. On Point is produced by Julie Jopp, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsanis, Hillary McQuilkin, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Karen Schiffman, and John Wibby. Our senior producer is Wen Stevenson. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.